Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
Welcome to Chawton House Library. My name's Ray Mosley. I'm the information officer here. Steve Lawrence sends his apologies to the CEO. He couldn't be with us today. He's doing something with the Duchess of Cornwall, I think. We won't go into what he's doing with the Duchess of Cornwall. I've got a couple of things first. One of those housekeeping things. When you do walk around the house, the floors are very wobbly, so please watch your step. And the second one's about fire, if there's a fire alarm. There are members of staff amongst you. They will be identified because they will be the ones that are running the fastest when the alarm goes. So if you attach yourself to them and follow them, you'll be fine. Those are the two very brief housekeeping things. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Adrian Thatcher. Some of you know him, some of you don't. Adrian was here for well over 10 years, right at the start of the restoration of the property. He knows it intimately, probably too intimately at some stages for his own health, I suspect. But I hope you enjoy his talk. It's normally very informative. When I first started here, I went to a couple of his talks and they were very, very good. He says he's rusty, hasn't done this for about 4 years, so please, 5 years.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Some of the dates might be dodgy, so I know there's a few of you amongst you
correct.
That will know the dates. So please no heckling, Jeremy. And I will pass you over to Adrian.
Right, as Ray said, I'm a little bit rusty, haven't done this for 4 or 5 years. I've been running through it for the past couple of weeks in my mind, and various things come back as you go through it. Essentially, I started here in 1995 as the restoration project manager. Sandy Lerner took me on to oversee the restoration of the house. I'd sort of turned up here and saw there was a sort of crumbling pile with tarpaulins on the roof. All the grounds were overgrown. And I was asked if I wanted to get involved with the project and help restore it. At which point she said, I'm off back to the States. I'll see you in 2 months. Let me know when I come back what you've decided. Anyway, needless to say, I did get involved with it. And it did form a very big part of my working life. For 13 years I was actually here from 1995, I think. Anyway, what I'm going to do today is try and sort of canter through the last 1,000 years history of the house and the estate in very sort of outline terms, rough terms. But I just want to canter through the sort of 1,000 years up to when Sandy Lerner founded the English charity that then took on the restoration of the house. And then I'll talk you briefly through the restoration of the house and the process of the planning and listed building consent, etc. So if we start at the beginning, I think I'm right in saying that there is mention to a manor at Chawton in the Domesday Book. It was a fairly sort of prominent manor. If we go through to the 13th century, King Henry III visited some 30 to 40 times. King Henry III at that time would have been travelling with an army of men, because at the time they were constantly feuding with the French. And there was a risk of being kidnapped or whatever. So when the king travelled, he would have travelled with his knights in armour and his merry men. So if you imagine turning up at Chawton, not this actual house, but if you imagine turning up in Chawton, you had maybe 100, 200 men with you who had to be fed, had to be watered, they would stay overnight. So it wasn't like going down to Sainsbury's and picking up a load of food for the 100 or 200 people that were going to come and get you. So it was a very prominent manor house, and for the king to visit, it was very important. It was a very prestigious estate. The reason I think that the king used to visit here at the time was the capital was Winchester. If you went from Winchester, a day's ride would be to Chawton, another day's ride to Guildford, another day's ride to London. So it was quite handy sort of stopping off point 20 miles or so each time, 20, 25 miles you travel in a day on horseback. So there is history to sort of back up that there were sort of carp ponds here and things like that, because you had to have fresh food available. When we did the restoration, we did find some remnants of the medieval manor house that was here. King Henry III held Chawton in high regard, because when he came to power, he ordered the felling of some oak trees to help with the construction of the manor house here. and that's actually documented in the royal records. One of the other things that were documented in the royal records around that time were that the king was going to visit, and before he visited, he sent, I think it was 4 tons of wine to Chorlton to preempt one of his visits. Well, when we say a ton, Tony, it was actually a barrel, a big barrel. That was what they sent in. But unfortunately, some highwaymen stole it before it got here. So the king, I should think, was pretty unhappy, and I wouldn't have liked to have been in their shoes had they been caught. But that's also documented, that this wine was stolen before it got here. We go on from that, and the estate started to fall into decline through the sort of 14th and 15th century. It started to decline, and there's record of no one really being in charge of the manor here. There were reports of poaching and people generally abusing the estate, and no one really looking out for the estate here. So it started to fall into decline. We come through then to the sort of 16th century, and the Knight family were tenant farmers here at that time, in the early sort of 1500s, 1530 I think onwards. They also had, there's records of Knight families at Fourmarks and surrounding villages. They were tenant farmers here, and in, I think it was around 1580, something like that, they actually took on the freehold. But this also coincided with the sale of some land at Fourmarks that the Knights were attributed to, and other sales in the area. Now, I think the reason that the Knights were able to afford to buy the estate, buy the manor of Chorlton, was they were tenant farmers here. Sheep farming was going very well. They were obviously farmers in their own right down at Fourmarks, or it was in the family. There was also some speculation as to whether they married well. Someone married well into the family and had some money that way. But they were able to buy the freehold of the estate around that time. And then I think it was John Knight in about 1585 who started the construction of this manor house here that we see today. When he started the construction, if you look at the picture on the board there, you can see it's actually half of an Elizabethan E. Here's the centre part of the E, but this side was never constructed. It would have formed a traditional Elizabethan hall. And I think the reason for that was, A, they were partly building on and over the original medieval manor house that was here, and partly the fact that at the time they probably couldn't afford to do all of it at one time. So I think, as we do today, I think they moved, were living in the medieval sort of manor house. It became dated, like a baronial hall. It wasn't very nice, didn't have mod cons, didn't have perhaps glass in the windows and things like that. So it was very, you know, drafty sort of place. They then wanted to modernise. The fashion at the time was this Elizabethan E. They started to construct it, and after, I think there's different phases, were about sort of 15 years. By that time, the fashion had changed. So we got into the sort of 1600s, and when we start to move through to the 1600s, there was definitely a different way of living, because you then didn't want everyone in the hall, the Knight family at the high end of the table and all the serfs down the low end. There was all of a sudden, it was a time when you wanted to segregate yourself from the people that were serving you and the lower sort of people in status. So that's when they started sort of building the servants' passage there, and things like that went on in the early 1600s and 1650. So it's fashion changed, the way we lived changed. If you can imagine when this house was built, this had glass, it had a lovely stone floor, part of which is left in the hallway there. It had glass in the windows, you had fireplaces, etc. What you've got to remember is down in the village there were a few cottages down there. They had a thatched roof. They had no glass in the windows, they had doors, they probably had dirt floors and a fire on the dirt floor, and that was it. So when this house was built, it was very much a statement, a prestige sort of house. And at the time, I think, is it Hampton Court? You know, they were aspiring really to you know, live like the hierarchy, the royals in the land. It was very fashionable to have an Elizabethan sort of house. So it's put it into context, because you look at this house really, and there are changes over the years, but the basic fabric of this part of the house dates back to 1585. So, you know, it was a very prestigious house in its day. We then sort of canter through the various knight family that have owned the house since then. We had John, and then we go on, and then the next big factor in it was the adoption of Edward Austin Knight. And I think we might be able to... That's the Mellishamp there. That actually, in 1740, that's how the house looked. So you can see the sort of half of the Elizabethan E, the stable block down here, which was 1593, which is one of the finest still remaining in Hampshire. But you can see they're a very formal landscape, can't you? It's all terraced, etc., etc. If we go on through there, you've got the calendars. By 1780, all that formal landscape, all the terraces and everything, have been swept away. So you've then got this lovely sort of open landscape movement, Capability Brown, etc. That was very much the sort of the fashion of the day, with the ha-ha, which you can just make out down there, which still remains today. That's the adoption, 1783. Edward Austin Knight was adopted by the Knight family. He was a cousin, so he was Austin, which is the Jane Austen connection. But he was adopted by the Knight family as being the favourite cousin. They were unable to have children, so to keep the Knight family name going, they adopted Edward. We've skipped a few centuries there. So anyway, Edward Austin Knight inherited this estate and also an estate down in Kent called Gobbleshire. So he was all of a sudden a very wealthy man. He had a lovely estate here, which I think in its heyday was about 5,000 acres, and the one down in Gobbleshire in Kent I think was about 2,000 acres. Gobbleshire in Kent was a more modern house. I think it was more Georgian, and therefore he chose to live there, and he let this house out. Although Edward did stay here for a year or two, when Gobbleshire was being renovated and modernised, etc. At that time, I think Jane Austen is reputed to have visited here a number of times and would have spent time in the dining room with her brother around the dining table. So that was a sort of key fact. That's where the Austen connection comes in. it was very generous of Edward that he actually provided a house in the village for his sisters and his mother, because at the time, I mean, women were expected to marry well. You know, they were at that time, you know, the class of people that they were expected to marry into money and what have you. That didn't happen. Edward provided a house for his mother, and it was, I think, the bailiff's house, which is now known as Jane Austen's house in the village. But you have to sort of put things in context, and he was under no obligation to provide anything for his sisters or his mother. It was very much down to, you know, and they chose not to marry, they didn't, so they were spinsters in the village, but he provided them with a very nice house, and they had a lovely lifestyle, as you know by the writings that Jane Austen did, because a lot of it was actually relevant to her experiences, and there are certain references in some of the books that you can definitely pick out as scenes from the landscape around Chawton House. We sort of went on from Edward Austin. We then canter through the next year. The house actually, Montague Knight was a big sort of player in the house's history, I think. Montague took the house on from his father Edward, who wasn't that Edward, there was another Edward in between. He actually took the house on about sort of 1900, 1890, something like that. When we do a little walk round the house, we'll see in the stained glass windows it's actually got the dates when they actually inherited. But Montague was a big player. He went to modernise the house. He wanted also to restore the house, put back some of the stone windows. He put all these windows in. Before that, there were Georgian windows in there. The house was stuccoed before that. So as time went on, they wanted, oh, we want a Georgian house now. You know, an Elizabethan house is not what we want. A Jacobean house is not what we want. We want a Georgian house. The parapet wall was added at the front, this bit here. And the house was all stuccoed, and so it was painted to make it look nice and sort of Georgianised. But Montague came along and was a bit of a historian, really, because he did a lot of research into the house's history, and he started to put it back as he thought it was in sort of Jacobean Elizabethan times. Montague spent an awful lot of money in doing this, because when we go round, you can see an awful lot of his work. After Montague, it did start to fall into decline. We had the First World War, the Second World War, and so on. So the First World War took a lot of people away from the estate, off to war. So a lot of big country estates did fall into decline because they didn't have the workers there to do it. Inheritance tax, each time a house was passed on, there was a huge inheritance tax. And, you know, the pot gradually dwindled. And I think during the Second World War, the house was used by Dr. Bernardo's as a home for children, homeless children and orphans. And I think when we opened, we did have a number of them came back to visit, didn't we, that remembered being here during the war as children, which was quite fascinating. Anyway, after the Second World War, continued to decline. The estate sold off the village in, I think, 1953, certainly sold the pub that was in the village, and a number of other houses there. So it was still declining gradually through the sort of 20th century. And then Richard Knight inherited in 1983. Is that right? Seven. Richard inherited in 1987, and, you know, it was a big old country house. Richard lived down in Cirencester, I believe. He had a farm down there. He inherited this big pile here, which was wanted millions spent on it, and he thought, well, how can I do this? He didn't want to lose the continuity of the Knight family name with the house and the estate, so eventually they came up with a scheme to actually turn it into a 36-hole golf and country club back in the 80s, when everyone wanted to play golf and there were new golf courses and country clubs being set up everywhere. Unfortunately, at the back end of the 80s, as some of you will remember, we started to fall into our last recession. And by 1992, we were fully in the depths of it, and the golf club consortium had gone bust. But in the meantime, they'd managed to strip the tiles off the roof on the South Range here, and it was under tarpaulin. So in comes the local authority, East Hants District Council, and slap an improvement notice on the house. Because it's a Grade 2 star listed building, it's fairly high on the list of, you know, sort of prestigious houses in Hampshire, and they wanted Richard to, you know, to make it safe and fix the roof, etc., etc. Well, there wasn't enough money to do that. Where do you start? Anyway, in, I think, 1993, in stepped Sandy Lerner. Sandy Lerner and Len Bosack were the co-founders of Cisco Systems. They sold their business in the early 90s, and I think it was only about 91, 92. They sold Cisco Systems for a phenomenal amount of money at the time, and they set up the Bosack Kruger Foundation. And the Bosack Kruger Foundation basically had a sum set aside for it to actually do various projects around the world, some of them environmental, some of them educational, etc. Sandy's pet project was she wanted to make this a library and a study centre. The reason she heard about Chilton House and its plight, she was at a Jane Austen AGM in America, and some of the people there were talking about buying the house and restoring it and making it a Jane Austen sort of museum. Anyway, Sandy Lerner heard this, thought, no, that's not going to work. I'll buy it and I'll turn it into a study centre through the foundation. Anyway, without actually physically being over here or seeing it, she spoke to the agents, got her PA to actually purchase it without actually being over here to see it. And it was, I think what we've got is there was a freehold and there was some leasehold. The leasehold is for the house itself because Richard did a commercial lease so that when the lease is up in another, the lease will be up in about 105 years, it will revert back to the Knight family, hopefully in slightly better condition than when it left their sort of control. But, you know, £10 million later, that's what you would expect. The freehold of the stables was sold, that is separate, and it was about £1.25 million, which actually when you look at it now, you think, oh, that's bargain. But not when you consider you had to spend £10 million in 10 years doing it. Anyway, so Sandy Lerner stepped in, said buy it. She bought it through the English charity. They set up an English charity, and the English charity went about then working out how they were going to try and restore this house and make it a study centre. And bring, at the time, I think Sandy had about 7,000 volumes of early English women's writing, which dated from about 1600 to about 1800. So that was her private collection. She's very keen on literature. Sandy's very passionate about education and educating people. And I think she's reputed to have read Pride and Prejudice some 40 times. So the Jane Austen thing is there, it's bubbling away in the background. She wants to make a study centre, do good to an English house and estate, and leave her mark, really. And it's, in the early days, when I was trying to convince the planners that this was a good thing, because when they first started, when we first started talking about the restoration, no one wanted to have a study centre here. They said, oh no, it's going to be a theme park, it's going to be a lesbian commune, and all. There were all sorts of rumours going around when I arrived in 1995. And part of the reason for that was that Len Bosack was involved with the Star Wars project in America. He's a, you know, he's a scientist, he's a very, very clever man. And he was involved in that, so there was some talk about it being a virtual reality theme park and all these things. And right from the outset, and you know, when I first met Sandy, she said my brief was to turn it into a study centre, and it would be a, you know, a free venue for people to come and study the literature here. And if any of you wanted to come and study the literature, some of you may have done, it is a free facility, which is, you know, funded by the charity and indirectly the foundation from America. Anyway, Sandy, sorry, I came along in 1995. Prior to that, there was a couple of people in suits, as Sandy said, with spaghetti alphabet after their names, architects mainly, that had tried to sort of talk her into how this was going to happen, how that was going to happen. And if any of you know Sandy or have read about Sandy, she doesn't do things in a traditional way. If Sandy can find a way of doing it that bucks the trend and bucks the norm, she will. So after about a year, 18 months of spending money and nothing really getting done, she happened upon me and said, do I want to come and do it? I said yes. And we started off then by putting together the historic reports. We had a report done on the historic landscape. That was done by Sybil Wade and Cassie Knight. Cassie Knight is the daughter of Richard Knight, the current freeholder of the property. And Cassie became involved with the project in quite some depth. One of my other briefs was Richard has another son called Adam, who's the eldest son, and he happened to be training as an architect in London. So Sandy said, what about if we had Adam as the architect? Go and find an architect's practice that will take Adam on and he can work on the project too. So I spent, I don't know, a year, 6 months, a year, whatever, coming up the Sybil Wade through, you know, it was a lot of help from Gilly Drummond at the time, Richard and different people involved in the trustees committee. And eventually we put this team together. I went to see Adam one day, and I tipped up at his flat in London by Tower Bridge, and I walked in the door and I thought, I can't believe this. There's two students and you couldn't get in the door. And he said, well, come in and have a cup of coffee. And I said, should we go out? Because there was about 3 months of crocks and pots and everything in the kitchen, as you can imagine, two bachelors living in London. Anyway, so we went out for a coffee and I talked to Adam, and he said, yeah, I'd be up for that. That would be interesting. Anyway, so then we set about finding an architect's firm. And we interviewed people from that had done Up Park, who'd helped with the restoration of Up Park. And I figured that they weren't probably going to be flexible enough to work with Sandy and these. Anyway, eventually we happened upon Nichols Brown Webber. They came highly recommended, and they were quite big into landscapes. Andy Nichols was big in landscapes. He's now very involved with Madame Tussauds and all these things. Quite a well-known landscape architect anyway. But anyway, so we interviewed them and we decided to take Nichols Brown Webber on. So then we had Adam, Nichols Brown Webber, Sybil Wade, Cassie Knight. Now we needed an archaeologist, we needed an architectural historian, because being a Grade 2 star listed building, before you can do anything, you've got to do your research. Sandy's brief was restore it to how it was in the sort of 1800s. Okay. We did that. So we took Edward Roberts, who was the architectural historian. He's written a few books for Hampshire County Council on historic buildings in Hampshire. Very highly regarded, very sort of soft play man. You know, he's very sort of modest and what have you, but he knows an awful lot about houses in Hampshire. And the other one was Christopher Curry. He was the archaeologist. Christopher sadly is no longer with us. He passed on some 10 years ago, I think, probably now. But Chris did a lot of the early research, and that's where some of the stuff about the royal records and about what happened at the manor here in the early days, it came from Chris's research. But anyway, all these reports were compiled. There had been reports before for the golf course, but they weren't really relevant to what we were trying to do, because we were trying to restore the house and the grounds. We did that. It took 2 years to compile all that and actually submit the planning application and the listed building consent. At that time, unfortunately, they discovered that we had some badges in the swimming pool. And there was a swimming pool in the South Lawn. Now, Richard recounts, I don't know, Jeremy might back me up on this, that from the day it was finished, it always leaked. It never held water. But anyway, there was this derelict swimming pool in the grounds, and the badgers had decided to move into the banks of the derelict swimming pool. And so they had many other sets around the estate. So this was their summer home by the pool. And they just used it through the summer, and then at winter and breeding, they moved elsewhere to their breeding set. The only thing was that all of a sudden there were a few things that went on that probably were a little bit underhand, and all of a sudden the Badger Society turn up and they're Save Our Badgers, and the local schools are doing pictures, and there's pictures appearing in the papers that we're going to destroy the badgers and kill all the badgers, etc, etc. All total poppycock and hype, but that's what happened. It delayed the project for some 9 months, cost about £100,000, but after much negotiation, resubmission for planning, another planning application, there was a big hoo-ha with English Nature, and Sandy said, if we can't get rid of that damn swimming pool, I'm not doing the project. She said, how can you have a lovely restored house and landscape with a derelict concrete swimming pool in the middle of the lawn? And she was quite right. So my brief was, we're not doing anything, stop work on everything till we get this planning permission. So I then spent the next 9 months convincing the listed building consent people, the planners and all the rest of it, that if they didn't start playing ball and start being sensible about this, that the project wasn't going to go ahead and they were going to be left with a big headache, because Sandy would disappear off back to the States and you could sue her as much as you like. She's in the States, you're not going to get anything. So eventually we played a bit of hardball and we got the planning permission. We got the listed building consent, we got the permission to remove the pool, we relocated the badges that weren't there anyway. We had... Well, because when we did it, you know, when they were in their breeding set over in the woods, and that was fine. And when we did the excavation of the pool, etc., we had English Nature there, we had our badger consultant and all the rest of it, and we found two voles and a hedgehog, I think. But there were no badgers. The set was redundant. They've moved out, basically. Badgers are shy creatures. As soon as we turned, you know, the house started to be occupied again and there was activity, they didn't want to be there, they wanted to be elsewhere. So we started the restoration. We had about four phases over 10 years, it was, actually. No, slightly less than 10 years, 8 years, I think it was. And we started with the South Range because we had the improvement notice, we had to re-roof the South Range. We then did some work, I think, down on the old coach house and what have you down there. We then did some work on the Elizabethan stables. We put some of the original featured windows back in and uncovered some of the original fabric of that building. And then we worked on round the various buildings here. Some of these will actually show you that. That was before we started. That was the flying link to the nursery. The nursery actually was, this is the nursery here. And it's over the game larder, so the children were very much removed from the house, definitely not heard, anyway. That was one of the things that was put on probably in the 1800s, so we decided that didn't particularly enhance the Elizabethan Jacobean sort of facade of the house, so we removed that. Again, we had to substantiate that, how we were going to remove it, why we wanted to remove it, etc. That's a picture. Just take a few minutes to look at that while I have a little drink because I'm a bit thirsty. That's how the house looked when I turned up in 1995. It was completely overgrown. Some of you will have parked out the back here. There's this old billiard wing here, which when you looked at the top of by the roof, there was a 4-inch gap in the wall where it was subsiding and pulling away from the Elizabethan manor house. This is the Elizabethan part of the house here, one of the original bits, and that was an extension put on it about 1850, 1860, and that was the Victorians. Massive extensions on houses at that time to accommodate their staff and billiard rooms, etc. So a lot of country houses doubled in size in the Victorian times. This is a sort of Montague steps and what have you. I don't think he put the plastic roof on there. There was a temporary boiler in there when I came, just trying to keep the house warm. You can see the old bell tower and the chimneys and what have you. That chimney stack now is an Elizabethan Jacobean chimney stack. It's been restored to its former glory, which was the diamond stacks. That was done in the Victorian times. And the same with this one here. That's been put back to how it was with the diamond stacks when we did the demolition.
Sorry, can I just stop on looking at the left-hand side of the picture?
Yeah.
It's sort of leaning in. Is that an optical illusion? Was that correct?
It's an optical illusion. There is a bit of subsidence in this building here, but it is seasonal. It goes and comes back. But no, it's not leaning that much. I think it's something to do with the lens on the camera, perhaps. That's some of the scaffolding that we started to put up. We put temporary roofs over the whole building in phases whilst we were doing the restoration, because obviously you can't afford for the rain to get in. One of the biggest jobs was repairing the roof and the roof timbers, and you can't afford for the rain to get in on all this lovely oak panelling. That's a picture of the South Range. That was the first roof that we did. The only problem is, when we did this, and I'm trying to think of the year, 87 was that great storm, wasn't it? We did that in about 98, and we had terrific winds, and we lost most of the sheeting off that, and I was expecting to come in and see the scaffolding and the temporary roof blown away, because we had sort of 70, 80 mile an hour winds. Well, the temporary roofs generally are only designed for 60 to 70 mile an hour winds. But the sheeting is designed to come away should you get really strong winds, and then the wind just blows through it. And luckily, that's what had happened. But a few sleepless nights. This is the great hall here. This is behind the screen, actually, the fireplace here, this lovely fireplace. part of the we struggled really to understand this, because an Elizabethan hall normally has the fireplace to one end, slightly towards the higher end of the hall, this being the high end of the hall, going on up to the parlour, etc. But we found this lovely fireplace there. The only problem was the flue that went off from it, etc., etc. We couldn't find any evidence that it was ever used. Now, there was no cert or anything. But one idea, speculation was it one of the fireplaces from the medieval house that was here? And if the medieval house had fallen into disrepair, as the records show, through the 14th or the 15th and 16th century, if the house became derelict, then, you know, over a period of 100 years, the weather acting on it could have quite well sort of washed all that away. There wouldn't have been much evidence left of it. So we never did quite get to the bottom of why a house was built in 1585 with a fireplace there, and then in 1614, fireplace put there. That fireplace was moved and extended in 1613, but certainly before that there was a fireplace there. So when we did the excavations around the building, we did find the evidence of the medieval manor house that was here. We found the West Country slate. We found some brickwork, etc., around the estate of the earlier medieval house, and stonework. When I say brickwork, I mean stonework. There's a culvert that runs underneath the scullery and the kitchen. And in the early days, they did report that it was a moated manor here. Well, at the back here, there was a steep ravine. And when we were going to underpin the servants' wing there, but we found that there was 4 metres of backfill. So it was a very steep ravine at the back of the house, and the Winterbourne River runs along the driveway there. So moated manor could have been that's what they were referring to as a moated manor. The reason it was moated was because in the medieval times you had to protect your property. You were very feudal at the time. There was no real law and order, and so you protected your property. Anyway, we never did get to the bottom of the fireplace, but there was some, you know, you can see the lovely big arch here. Can you see above it, brick arch there, and the big stone fireplace? I have a funny feeling it was something to do with the medieval manor house that was here. We've got part of the undercroft that was here. There are various alterations to the cellars here, and some of the arches have been taken off and new arches put on in a different style. And again, that was all down to fashion and what have you. At the time, they changed from a three-centre arch to a round arch and things like that. And Edward was of the same opinion that the cellars here don't line up with the external walls of the Elizabethan house. They're within that. So if you were going to put a cellar in and you built a house, you would put it to the extent of the perimeter walls, the external walls. You're not going to build a wall and then another wall. So I think they very much built on and around the medieval house that was here. And that fireplace sort of kind of makes sense with that. The walls also aren't square. It's slightly, they've accommodated walls, I think, from an earlier house. Anyway, behind this there, there's an old doorway, and there was lard and plaster, and we actually found 6 musket balls in behind that. Well, bearing in mind the panelling was put in 1613, 1614, someone was obviously using something as target practice before that time, standing at the far end of the wall. I don't know what they were shooting at, but anyway, we found those. One of the other things you can see here is we took the floors up here to integrate the modern services, the fire alarm system, the data, the power, etc., etc. And on All Saints Day, I think it was in 2001, Carpenter took a bottle that he found under the floor to the site agent, Steve. Steve came round to my office and said, look what we found. We found a champagne bottle that had the cork put back in and a wax seal put over it. And in fact, there was a message in it. Anyway, we got all excited. We didn't open the bottle. I took it to Edward Roberts, the architectural historian, because he's very familiar with old English language. And he could see it was a 17th century. It was 17th century. So he said, blimey, this is fantastic. Anyway, we eventually plucked up the courage to open it. We opened it, and we found the message in the bottle. It was written by Montague in the absence of his father on All Saints Day, I think it was 1868. His father being away at the seaside, so Edward was down on the south coast, perhaps at Brighton, taking the waters in a bathing machine or whatever, and Montagu had been left in charge of the restoration project. And he decided to cut up an old 17th century landy, because that's what the message was written on, and put it in the champagne bottle and put it under the floor before they put this timber floor down. But it was quite spooky that the carpenter found it on All Saints Day in 2001. So we took the message out, we put our own message back in the bottle, put it back under the floor, and a copy of that one, and said what we were doing on All Saints Day 2001. There are a number of other interesting things that we did find during the restoration of the house. In the powder room that we called it, or the panelled room, just above the staircase on the first floor, they were removing some panelling again to put in some services and fireproofing between the walls. And they found a psioptic ball and a telescope, the psioptic ball being a bit like a camera obscura, and a telescope, and that was due to the time when they were put there. There was a cupboard above the fireplace, and it was a telescope was made out of paper with a lens, with lenses either end, rolled paper, very tightly rolled, leather bound. We still have that, I think, in our archives. But that was a popularisation of the sciences. It was very fashionable for gentlemen to, in the 60s, I think it was 1650s or whatever, to be, you know, looking at the stars and experimenting with these things. Anyway, we discovered those, which was of great interest. They're now part of the archive. We found all manner of bones, boots, glass, etc. behind the walls. All those sorts of things. Boots were there to be lucky, bones, glass, to ward off the evil spirits. We found a number of signs carved in there in the Middle Ages and Elizabethan times, actually. They would carve different symbols, and on the actual door in the courtyard to the kitchen, you can see some of these symbols that have been carved in there to ward off the evil spirits. It was quite fashionable at the time also to bury cats in the walls. We didn't find cats, but we did find a lot of rats. All sorts of things, too many to mention really now. But a very fascinating project. That's Sandy Lerner, as she is today with her turkeys in Virginia. She runs an organic farm over there, which is an old tobacco farm, but she's turned it into an organic horse, cattle and turkey and whatever else. I mean, that's the house as we see it today, or as it's not actually, because that wasn't there in 2003. I can't believe that in July 2003 we actually opened, and that's when my job really finished as the restoration project manager. I stayed on for another 3 years after that, and running part-time, running the estate. But that's basically the last 1,000 years of Chawton House that I can remember. And hopefully I didn't get too many of the dates wrong. Have any of you got any questions?
What was the reason that particularly prompted the removal of the panelling behind your screen to reveal that fireplace?
To integrate services, there were a number of repairs that we had to do. Some of the panels were rotten, and we decided we would want to repair those. That's how we were able to get an accurate date of when they were done, because they were dendrodated. The panels were actually dendrodated, so we could get an accurate date of when they were done. It was mainly to get services in there and things like that. So, you know, we only did it where we had to, but, you know, there were some walls that have had to be fireproofed as well. Try and, you know, should the horrible event happens, try and slow down the spread of fire through the building. Part of one of the requirements for building regulations, you know, being a study centre, you've got people on various floors throughout the house, so you need to have that fire protection in place, and then a very elaborate fire alarm system.
Yeah. Were you able to tell when it had last been done?
Some of the, yeah, some when well, actually, one particular thing springs to mind there. The range over the roof over the kitchen wing. We thought we had a Jacobean extension there of about 1650, 1660. We did when we took the when we first took the dendrodates. That's what we had. But when we took the roof off, we found the Elizabethan roof underneath it. And there was a complete roof underneath the roof that had been put on in 1655. Now, was it 1650? Something like that. It was when the young knight was in charge. Young knight was in charge. He was about 7 or 8. So there were people looking after the affairs of the estate. And they decided to do this modernisation. There was an awful lot of work done around that period. And for some reason, they just built another roof over the top of the other one. Whether it was because to make the ridges line up, whether it was fashionable. But the roof underneath, I thought, perhaps they had a fire. But there's no evidence of any fire or anything. So they definitely put a roof over the top of the Elizabethan roof that was there. When they were last worked on, various stages around the house. The roofs probably had the original tiles on there, 400 years old. He may have re-roofed, but not all of it. It's something really that would have been ongoing. If you imagine, that part needs redoing, this part doesn't, and there was no one set point. You didn't think, in 1900 I'm going to re-roof the whole thing. So very difficult to sort of pin down a date, but certainly we found some of the old peg tiles with pegs in. So they definitely probably dated back to that time. But the tiles survive, the battens that they're on don't. So, probably every 40 to 60 years it gets redone. Hopefully now we'd be 60 to 100 years with the materials that you're using now. But it is something, throughout the age of the house, 400 odd years, it's probably been re-roofed sort of half a dozen times.
Did you leave the roof there?
Yes.
There's still two roofs
up there. I mean, the ethos behind a restoration and repair is very much, if it's not broken, don't fix it. And you leave as much of the original fabric as possibly, humanly possible, and maintain the fabric of the building. Anything you do as an alteration to the listed building should be reversible, with the exception of building the billied wing back on or whatever. That was a structural issue and a cost issue. But any of the alterations that are made, there should be evidence of what was there before, and it should really be reversible if at all possible. So if you take a wall out, you can put it back. And it's intervention only as and when you need to, when it's absolutely necessary. It took us an awful long time to negotiate with the English Heritage, David Brock, the local authority, Hampshire District Council Conservation Officer, East Hants District Council Conservation Officer. So there's all these parties that have to be consulted. And I remember sitting around the table in the library with about 10 of these people there, negotiating, going through all the plans, painstakingly going through the plans, proposing what we were going to do, and them saying no, we can't do that, and then building control would say, well, we have got to introduce some fire safety into the building, so we're going to have to do that, otherwise it can't be used for this course. So there is a compromise, because unless you have a use for a building like this, who's going to invest the money in repairing it, restoring it and altering it if it doesn't have an end use? So you have to, the ethos is that you have to allow some change, you have to bring it into the, the modernisation. And let's face it, the house as we see it now is a series of overlays really from 1580 through to present day, and each owner that's had it has put their mark on the building. They've altered it as we all do our own homes now. They change the paint colour, they change the layout of the kitchen, they change the roof, they change the windows and so forth, and that's gone on for centuries. But that's what makes the house so interesting. The other thing is with this house, we were fortunate really that in the last century there wasn't a huge amount of money. Montagu was the last person to make the alterations. and he collected things on his grand tour and introduced them into the building. A lot of arts and crafts things have come into the building. But in the last century, it wasn't modernised. There wasn't a modern... They didn't rip the Elizabethan sort of kitchen out and put a new modern kitchen in and things like that. So we were very fortunate that, you know, we had had those two world wars from the house's point of view, that there wasn't the funds and the people available to actually restore the house and modernise it, because it was like going back in a time warp when you... It still is to a certain degree, but when I walked round here, it had had, I think, I don't know, 8 years worth of cobwebs and not been occupied, and, you know, tarpaulin. It was really quite eerie walking around some of the parts, and that, you know, there were holes in the roof where, you know, the water had got in and started to rot the beams, etc. But it does make it one of sort of Hampshire's sort of great houses, really, because it is so largely untouched in the last century.
Were the planning authorities specific materials you needed to use?
Yeah.
All
specified.
Did you have problems sourcing them?
Did
you have to go abroad for wood or anything?
No. All the oak came from the UK in the timber repairs in the roof. Some of the stone would have possibly come from France, because there's a lot of the Marne stone. The closest place you can get it is northern France. And there aren't any quarries over here now for a lot of the stone that was used in the Elizabethan house. Yeah. I think the idea now was that we were going to have a wander around the house. Unless ever, when are we due for tea and coffee?
It's half past 11, but doesn't matter.
Were we going to do tea and coffee?
Do tea and coffee?
We can do tea and coffee, and then those of you that want to wander around the house with me can do so when we've had a quick cup of tea and a biscuit, perhaps. Yeah? Okay. I think we're going to go and have a tea, and then some of the numbers are coming out, and then
right, okay. Yeah. Right, yeah.